I'm here with conductor Stephen Jarvie. He's leading the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra in their upcoming concerts on Thursday and Friday. Stephen, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you start off by telling us about those works we'll hear on the concerts?
Well, this concert is all based around the idea of musical friends. The very famous Elgar Enigma Variations is all different theme and variations on his friends, different people that he had met throughout his life. And on that kick of friendship, I decided that we could start the performance with my dear friend Adam Schoenberg's Finding Rothko, which is a wonderful piece written in 2004, I believe, and it is not scary new music. It is very tonal, luscious, gorgeous music, all based on four different Mark Rothko paintings. And then my dear friend Susie Yang, who I've known for the last decade and have been in the New World Symphony with and the Kansas City Symphony, we are getting together for our first ever concerto together with the Dvorak Concerto. So Dvorak's cello concerto is a big powerhouse monster of a piece, and she is a powerhouse player. So I'm really excited about this program.
I'm intrigued by this Finding Rothko piece. I've never heard of this composer, and the backstory for the work is quite interesting. Can you share that with us?
Adam, he is not related to Arnold Schoenberg. He is Adam Schoenberg, and he's from Massachusetts, now lives in Los Angeles. He was inspired by some of these large-scale Rothko paintings. If you have ever seen any of Mark Rothko's work, it's actually quite large. You know, when you see the pictures in books, you think, oh, that's a red square. But they're actually very imposing works, and the way he puts all these different layers of paint and even like kind of shellac and all these different things onto the paintings gives it such depth. And it's not that each one of these movements is directly inspired, like, ooh, this is my sound world of red. It's just kind of the impression that the piece made for him. So it is made up of red, yellow, orange, and wine. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of what happens in the famous pictures at an exhibition. We have this, what he calls the Rothko theme, which are these set of chords that almost feels like it's taking us from painting to painting. And I don't think he thought of that literally, like walking through a gallery, as much as something like Pictures at an Exhibition, Mussorgsky's famous piece. But he just kind of uses this theme as connective material so that you know you're going into the next world of the paintings. And this piece can be performed with the works actually projected above the orchestra. We're not doing that for this particular concert just because of the logistics of lights and stands and things. But they're beautiful works, and I encourage people to look at them. And he even got to go to the Rothko Chapel, which is one of these kind of large-scale installations that was really made just for Rothko's work. And so Adam did a lot of research and depth and insight into this, and his music goes from anywhere from a very tonal, warm sound that sounds a lot like film music to some kind of almost random scratchy sounds that represent one of the paintings red. And so you get a really wide contrast, and it ends with just this big kind of sonic hug of warm string sounds as we end with the color, the painting wine.
Will you share a little bit about your own musical path? Tell us how you ended up becoming the man who leads the orchestra.
Well, I've kind of been all over the place. I grew up in a small town called Grand Haven, Michigan, which is kind of a Lake Michigan vacation town, and nice and quiet. And I played the piano and the saxophone, and I sang a little bit. And I found I had sort of a knack for musical leadership as I formed my own saxophone quintet, because I really enjoyed classical music, but I don't play the clarinet and the oboe and the flute and these things. So I wanted to arrange some classical music for a saxophone. And that musical leadership was taken note of by one of my teachers. And then I went on to the University of Michigan, where I studied music theory and conducting. And then from there, I went to the Peabody Conservatory at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And then I moved to New York with $1,000 and no plan. And $800 of that went immediately to my apartment. So I was out of cash pretty quick, but I was determined that New York was the most inspiring place for me. That's where music was happening. My friends were living there. And I got a temp job stuffing envelopes at the New York Philharmonic. It was their subscription season, sending out tickets. So I would go to the New York Philharmonic every day as a temp. And then we had the blackout, the famous blackout of it was August 17th, 2003. A lot of the Northeast went black, and I was the only guy that showed up to work the day after the blackout. And so they said, wow, that's a dedicated temp. And so I had a job at the New York Philharmonic for a year where I was working in the ticket office, and I would skip my lunches and watch Lauren Mazel rehearse the New York Philharmonic, and then I moonlighted as an opera conductor. And one day I got a phone call from a friend of mine from college who said, Plácido Domingo is looking for the famous operatic tenor, is looking for a conductor for his young artist program at the Washington National Opera in D.C. And I said, yes, please. And I auditioned for the staff of the Washington National Opera, and then they actually sent me out to work with Mr. Domingo as kind of a final round at his Operalia opera competition in Los Angeles. The maestro, who I will affectionately impersonate, but please know I love him dearly, kept on saying, oh, Steve, I will throw you in. It's okay. You will conduct something. It'll be that's dead on, by the way. And so for days, he just kept saying he was going to kind of throw me into the pit, and I would just try something out. I didn't even know what I was going to be conducting. I just had to be prepared. And finally, we were running out of time, and I said to him as a joke, he said, oh, Steve, I'm so sorry. We keep running out of time. I don't have time to throw you in. And I said, well, I have all these tenor arias here. We could sing one through one of those and I could conduct. And he said, okay. So my first job was won by conducting Plácido Domingo through Che Gelli da Manina from La Boheme. And then he said, that's not hard enough. Do you know Donde Lieta, the Act 3 La Boheme aria? And I said, yes. Do you want me to go grab a soprano? And he said, no, I got it. And so I am actually the only person to conduct Plácido Domingo in the role of Mimi. And the guy knew it cold. It was pretty darn amazing. And then he still had me conduct something else the next day. But then I won my first position. I started working at the Washington National Opera. And then I started working in New York City Opera. So I was splitting my time between New York and D.C. My lovely then-girlfriend, now-wife, Joanne, was always living in our Chelsea apartment in Manhattan. And then I started working for the New World Symphony in Miami Beach and did that same commute, New York to Miami, for a couple years, which was not rough, I have to be honest. Winters in Florida and summers in New York was okay. And so I had an incredible experience with the New World Symphony, which is where I actually met Susie Yang, our soloist. The New World Symphony, for those of you that don't know, is America's only orchestral training academy. The only thing you need to be a member of that ensemble is a bachelor's degree. It's basically the best 22 to 30-year-old players training to be in elite orchestras. And there's now members of the New World Symphony in most major orchestras in the world. I met a lot of great colleagues there. We all lived in a hotel together on South Beach, which is a unique artistic scenario for a 20-something. And then I got a job with the Kansas City Symphony, and my whole family up and moved to Kansas City, and I was there for 4 years as the associate conductor of the Kansas City Symphony, and now moved across the state to St. Louis, where I'm just ending my tenure. I've been with the St. Louis Symphony for 4 years as their resident conductor and also as the music director of the St. Louis Symphony Youth Orchestra.
What a journey.
Yeah, it's been all over the place, right?
So you've had a lot of experience working with singers. How is that different than working with either an orchestra by itself or instrumentalists with an orchestra? Are those experiences basically the same, or are you kind of working with two different beasts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think opera is kind of the ultimate conducting challenge. You are a very necessary part of the equation to communicate between the stage and the musicians in the pit. The human voice is the kind of most natural instrument, obviously. We are all singing through our instruments, whatever instrument we're playing. So being able to actually be with a singer's breath and kind of be inside their body and feeling that, oh, she's just got a little bit left. I love that feeling of the real time working with the singer's air and sound. I also really love going to work where it's hugs and kisses and drama. And I mean, the day at the opera house is a much different day than at the symphony orchestra. A symphony orchestra is using its time extremely efficiently. These are the pro of pros, but there isn't costumes and there isn't characters we need to talk about, and we don't need to block out the staging. So orchestral musicians have a very efficient and vigorous afternoon when they're working. And at the opera house, it's equally vigorous, just completely different in terms of how you're spending your time putting the things together. And I think there's a lot more, again, hugs and kisses at the opera house. I'm sure the symphony's got some hugs and kisses, but
They are not in short supply in opera,
sure, that's for sure.
Now, you're here in Knoxville as a candidate for the music director position with the KSO, and I don't want you to give anything away, of course, but can you share with us your impressions of Knoxville and the orchestra and what your hopes are for the ensemble if you're selected for this position?
Oh, I can give it all away. My impressions of Knoxville have only been for the last 24 hours. Some friends of mine live here, and I know a couple of people in the orchestra, and they've always talked about what a high-level musical group it is, what a kind group it is, both things that are very important to me. So far, I've found Knoxville incredibly charming, and I love that I can see the mountains in the distance, and there's water, and I don't know, it seems like a very beautiful place. My family is looking for a place to settle down and raise our two children, and this community seems like a place that I can imagine us doing that. But I'm looking forward to seeing more. I can't wait to see your art museum, and apparently the Tennessee Theater where we're performing is just one of the most outstanding. The pictures took my breath away, so I'm really looking forward to that. And of course, you know, hearing the ensemble. But this is a really special concert for me to have a piece I really care so deeply about, all of this music, and I also care very deeply about the people that are performing it and wrote it. My love for music and people is what this weekend is sort of about.
Any particularly favorite moments that you're excited to share with audiences at the concerts this week?
What I love about performing Finding Rothko and all of Adam Schoenberg's music is that it is the most talked about thing at the intermission or after the concert. People are so surprised that they liked it that much. It's so beautiful and varied and accessible, but still interesting. I mean, there's a lot of great things happening there. So I love watching the audience and hearing the audience behind me. I don't think people actually realize that. The conductors can feel the audience behind us. The musicians can feel the audience. So it's a real part of the performance experience. So when I hear people not going and rustling in their chairs because I know that they're just captivated by my dear friend's music, and he's one of the top 10 most performed living composers right now. His works are everywhere, and there's even a new disc of his music that'll be coming out very soon. So I love watching people respond to Adam's pieces. I think that the audience will definitely pick up on the fact that Susie Yang and I are friends. She played at my wedding. I've always found her one of the most lovely and funny and enjoyable people to be around as a person, but she is a powerhouse cellist. This is a person that you can't believe somebody's that tiny is making so much sound. So it's just going to, I think that the audience will really enjoy seeing our chemistry on stage, because I think it's going to be something unavoidable. Just our smiles and winks at each other are going to be a really enjoyable thing for me. And Elgar Enigma Variation, just the form of theme and variation is something that's very accessible, but it also kind of takes us on a journey. Elgar's theme, this enigmatic theme that he has developed, right, turns into every imaginable personality. Nimrod is the Nimrod variation, which is about two friends talking on a porch at night about Beethoven and the beauty of Beethoven's music, is a really emotional and important piece to me. Right after 9/11, the Friday, if everybody remembers, the Friday kind of nationwide candlelight vigil after 9/11, I was living in Baltimore, and I had actually just been in New York 2 days before. When the candlelight vigil was happening, I went to the Baltimore Symphony to see the opening night, and they played the Nimrod variation. And we all just sat there and wept. And then one man, I'm getting teary thinking about it, and then one man stood up in the middle of the audience and started singing God Bless America. I mean, that moment, I mean, I will be in tears during Enigma, because it just reminds me of how powerful music can be and how it can bring people together. And I think the audience will feel that. And plus, like I said, any of this idea of theme and variation is a journey, you know. So by the end, when you hear bom-ba-dee-da-la-da-da-dee-da, when you've heard that theme in every imaginable form, it's like you've followed a hero's journey, and we finally have come to such a glorious and victorious end. And I love the wide open beauty and optimism of this piece. It also shows off the orchestra very beautifully. It shows off gorgeous string sound, lovely viola solos, concertmaster solo, cello solo, beautiful little woodwind passages, just a lot of character in that music. I guarantee people will love this. I will go that far. I guarantee you, you will love this concert.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming in. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
Conductor Stephen Jarvie. He's leading the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra in their upcoming concerts on Thursday and Friday nights. They'll be performing Dvorak's Cello Concerto, The Enigma Variations by Elgar, and Finding Rothko by Adam Schoenberg. The performances take place on Thursday, April 14th, and Friday, April 15th. Both are held at the Tennessee Theater and start at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at knoxvillesymphony.com or by phone 865-291-3310.